This is an ABC podcast.
Radical left criminals, thugs, and others all throughout our country and throughout the world will not be allowed to set communities ablaze. We won't let it happen.
All across America, the death of George Floyd has touched a very, very raw nerve.
We're looking at live pictures here of Los Angeles where these protests are gaining momentum. We're seeing it turn violent with several cars, police vehicles that have been torched there. Many buildings around the city have also gone up in flames. And this is happening in around 30 states around America.
The fury of Americans over the death of George Floyd seems to, if anything, be intensifying. Footage of a Minneapolis police officer kneeling on the 46-year-old's neck for almost 9 minutes has been seen around the world. Four officers have been fired and one of them has been charged with third-degree murder. But the riots have spread to new cities each day as the public vents decades of accumulated anger over deaths just like this one. I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley. And today on The Signal, the death of George Floyd and the ballooning civil unrest in the US. How is it that America reached this point, and is there any hope it can bridge its racial chasm?
So it's hard to say exactly when, but at some point in the last week, the reaction to George Floyd's death went from being something that we've seen before to something that we haven't, at least not on this scale.
Yeah, the pictures of violence and rage and exasperation coming out of the US over the weekend especially have been truly astonishing. So it's been almost a week since George Floyd died. It was last Monday in the US around 8 o'clock at night in Minneapolis when a worker at a convenience store called the police saying a man had tried to use a counterfeit $20 note. Two police officers show up, see George Floyd sitting in a nearby parked car, and believing that he matches the description, they approach. Then more officers arrive, and George Floyd is handcuffed and pulled from the car. What happens next has been witnessed now by many millions of people via footage captured on a bystander's phone.
You can't live, man.
And in this footage, you can see an officer kneeling on George Floyd's neck. It goes on for almost 9 minutes. And as you can hear, he's saying things like, "I can't breathe," and "don't kill me."
What do you want?
I can't breathe. Please, in the name of the...
He begs for help, and one officer seems to be taunting him, telling him to get up even as he's holding him down.
Bro, get in the car, man.
I will.
All the while, more and more people stop and try to intervene.
How long I gotta hold him down?
Right, but they're prevented, even physically at one point, because another officer is standing guard to make sure that doesn't happen.
Eventually, George Floyd passes out, an ambulance is called, and he's taken to hospital, where he is declared dead.
The next morning, police announce the death in a press release. They also say George Floyd had been resisting arrest, a claim that hasn't been corroborated. Later on Tuesday, he's named and identified as a bouncer at a local club before he lost his job as a result of the COVID-19 lockdown. All the while, the video of him being pinned to the ground is spreading fast on social media.
The protests start on night one, Tuesday night. By that evening, thousands of people have gathered. The police headquarters are damaged and police push back. They even fire rubber bullets.
The next morning, Wednesday, the four officers are named. Derek Chauvin, Thomas Lane, Tu Tao and J. Alexander Kung. There are more protests at police headquarters that night, shops and cars are looted, more rubber bullets fired, and tear gas. One man is killed by a business owner. And protests are cropping up in other cities, places like Memphis and Los Angeles.
On Thursday, the National Guard deploys 500 soldiers in Minneapolis and the adjoining city of St. Paul. Protesters storm the Minneapolis police station and set it on fire. Donald Trump weighs in on Twitter saying, among other things, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," which is pretty emblematic of the response from the federal government. It's been highly critical of the protesters every step of the way.
On Friday, we find out Chauvin, the officer filmed with his knee on George Floyd's neck, has been arrested. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, a curfew is introduced, but people turn out to protest anyway, and the looting and burning spreads, and not just locally.
So the protests are more or less nationwide by this point. By Saturday, they are happening in 48 cities. Mayors are ordering people off the streets in LA, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, and in Miami. Governors in at least 8 states call the National Guard, not that that necessarily does much to clear the streets.
And those rallies quickly take on the same intensity as the ones in Minneapolis. In Nashville, Tennessee, City Hall is set on fire. 2 police vans in New York City run over a group of protesters. The White House goes into lockdown at one point because there are rioters more or less at the gates. The CNN building in Atlanta is stormed.
And a number of people have died by now just in the riots themselves, not at the hands of police, but when a member of the public has shot someone. Also, a lot of police have been injured along the way, too many to mention the individual cases.
On Saturday in Minneapolis, the Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman announces Chauvin has been charged.
I'm here to announce that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is in custody. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been charged by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with murder and with manslaughter.
The move is criticized as inadequate by George Floyd's family, among others.
They all need to be convicted of first-degree murder and given the death penalty because they didn't care about what they wanted to do with my brother. He wasn't a person to them. He was scum. He was nothing. And I can imagine how many people they did like that. I don't need them on the streets to kill anybody else.
And so the protests escalate. And unsurprisingly, there are now a lot of conflicting claims about who is to blame for the most hardcore violence. The mayor in Minneapolis says white supremacists and organized crime groups are now exploiting the chaos for their own ends. And more generally, critics of the protests say they're now no longer about the death of George Floyd and that they're being co-opted to serve a separate political agenda.
So the situation is incredibly raw and tense. And people are furious because it's far from the first time there's been a death like George Floyd's in America.
You could look at newspapers from the 60s and 50s and see examples of killings of black men and some black women by the hands of police, you know, the Jim Crow South. And, you know, this is something that's been, been building for decades.
That's Donald Earl Collins. He's an African-American author and a professorial lecturer in American history at American University in Washington, D.C.
Ferguson was a flashpoint because of the killing of Mike Brown in August of 2014, but that didn't lead to any sort of lasting change. And now we're under an administration where both in the national level and, quite frankly, in cities across the country, which seem to have signaled that it's open season for police to do whatever they want. And, when you combine it with really a lot of really bad stuff happening across the country economically, obviously epidemiologically and in other ways and shapes and forms, you've got a powder keg. That's the situation.
And perhaps most relevantly to the current situation, in 2014 in Ferguson, Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, wasn't charged.
We begin with those breaking developments tonight near St. Louis, Missouri, after the police shooting of that unarmed teenager. Today, the Ferguson police chief releasing the name of the police officer involved in the shooting after so much anger it was being withheld.
The officer that was involved in the shooting of Michael Brown was Darren Wilson.
The St. Louis County grand jury has chosen not to indict Darren Wilson.
They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the 5 indictments.
As all of you know, a few minutes ago, the grand jury deliberating the death of Michael Brown issued its decision. First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. So we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction.
The system is not broken, it was built that way. The system is not broken, it was built that way.
Let's talk about that, the more recent history. You mentioned Ferguson, Missouri. There was, as you say, a wave of similar kind of protests, perhaps not quite at the scale that we're seeing now, that was part of the Black Lives Matter movement. What was the response, if any, in the wake of those protests? What did authorities say? And, you know, was any meaningful change kind of made to address some of the concerns of people that were protesting then?
The short answer is not much. I mean, the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice conducted a 16-month investigation of the Ferguson, of the shooting of Mike Brown, and, you know, in response to the Ferguson uprisings. And basically, they put down a big report saying that Ferguson police and St. Louis County Police needed to reform themselves on the basis of any number of things, that they were over-policing the Black community. So that's about as much as been done. You know, a couple people tried to run against the DA to try to get them out of office. They failed, I think, at that. But other than that, no. Not much. Nothing's really changed in Ferguson since 2014, and it did not have an impact in terms of changing the nature of policing in the United States as a whole.
Has the attempt by some police departments in the United States to improve diversity among police officers, to actively recruit people of color to join the police service, has that in any way helped address this problem?
No. There's something known as the thin blue line, you know, which has been made famous primarily by the New York City Police Department or NYPD, where they build what is known as the blue wall of silence, so that regardless of what went down, even if you happen to be Latinx, even if you happen to be Black, even if you happen to be Asian, and you see someone who is Black or Latinx or Asian being discriminated against, getting beat up, possibly being killed, you are not going to step up and testify against that person. And so it doesn't really matter that there are more Blacks in the police force now than there were 50 years ago, that there are more Latinx folks in the police force than there were 30 or 40 years ago. Because in point of fact, they work for a system that, you know, once they put on the uniform, the badge, put on the gun, taser, you know, mace, can, whatever, they represent a system in which they're acting on the express sort of principles within that system, and those principles are racist principles. So no, that's not being, having more Blacks, just adding more, you know, people of different backgrounds to the force doesn't change the nature of the institution.
In the case, you know, that we started talking about, the George Floyd case, the fact that the officers are being charged, is that different to what's happened in the past, or have we seen this happen in the past and that hasn't been enough?
We've seen it happen in the past. We've seen it with Walter Scott. We've seen it with the case that was in Baltimore in 2015. We've seen it with cases, other cases in New York over the years. We've seen it in other places where people have been charged with a crime, right? Where they've even gotten to the point where they might have even been indicted for a crime. But very seldom has even an indictment led to a guilty conviction or jail time or sentencing or anything along those lines. The truth is that until that starts happening, and it happens more often than not, we're stuck with the same situation where at best you might get some arrest. At best, you might get, some people might get cop a plea and end up, you know, serving, you know, minor jail time for some violation or another. Mostly what these cities do is put away slush funds in order to pay families for the mistakes their police officers make. That's where we are.
You've written, you were writing more about the COVID-19 pandemic, but as you say, that's important context to what's happening now. But you've written about what future historians might say about the United States in this period of history that we're living through, and you know, you suggested that they might conclude that the United States has failed. Can you just walk us through how you see this, how you see this situation being described in the history books in centuries from now?
I think what we're looking at is, if things, you know, depending on how things work out, you never know. But the truth is that we're in a fairly crappy period where between climate change, pandemics, you know, the rise of the right, far right in many countries around the world, and the weakening of democracies all over the world, including the United States. The truth is that when historians look back at this period, they're going to see the distance between what America calls its ideals, freedom, democracy, equality, right? You know, we're so-called leaders of the free world. That's free world. That's at least what we like to say to folks, right? But at the same time, there's this reality where many people outside the United States, and certainly plenty of people in the United States, see the U.S. as a superpower that believes in unbridled capitalism, a superpower that refuses to apologize for historical mistakes like slavery. So when I talk about how the U.S., how historians will lament, they'll see this distance between these ideals and between the reality of the U.S., and they'll say, well, why did these people live their lives as if, you know, this hypocrisy was completely okay?
Do you think that sense, that perspective partly explains the almost nihilistic quality of the protests now? There's this gaping frustration at, you know, because that's how it looks to lots of people.
Well, the protest is multi-layered. There are people who are out there who are literally just protesting because of what happened to George Floyd and what's happened to Breonna Taylor, what's happened to Arbery, and what's happened to so many other African-American men and women and boys and girls over the years. So there's that group. There's a group of people who are just anarchists, and they're mostly white, and already we're already getting reports that a lot of these people in Minneapolis who have been breaking things and setting cars on fire, so mostly been white folks coming into these protests, because their frustration's different, and they're using these other protests to basically protest, you know, in a very, what you would call, a nihilistic sort of fashion. So there's that part. There are certainly other folks who might be Black, who might be Latinx. We're very happy to see the police station in the third precinct in Minneapolis go up in flames 2 days ago. So there's that group. So it's multi-layer. The nihilistic part probably is the equation of the fact that, hey, we're in the middle of a pandemic. People aren't staying 2 meters apart, right?
Yeah.
You know, not everyone's wearing masks. There's that part to this as well. You know, you have to kind of weigh both sides of it. I'm going to go so far as to say these people are being nihilistic. They're just extremely frustrated, angry, upset, tired of being worn down and worn out and run over by a system that refuses to recognize their basic humanity. I would say one other thing, and this is part and parcel of the reality of protesting when you are part of what some people see and what I see as an oppressed group within the United States, and that is this expectation that people conduct peaceful protests, follow protocol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The problem with that is, when you are consistently faced with violent act after violent act after violent act, and you're protesting in response to violent acts. In the history of the planet, most people who, you know, respond to violence typically with violence. Now, I'm not arguing that people should be violent. What I am arguing, though, is that I understand why people are being violent in the midst of constantly being inundated week after week with violent acts that oftentimes are caught on camera. You know, to expect a group of people to be nonviolent, consistently nonviolent, consistently we shall overcome kumbaya kind of protest in the midst of all this violence is quite frankly unrealistic.
That is the signal for today. We will be right here in your feed at the same time tomorrow. We'll catch you then.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.